Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for spending a nice Sunday evening with me as you get ready to go back to work, go back to school. Nice, sunny, hot day today. I wanted to make one comment on this top story about Senator John McCain's passing. What a great man. I don't know that I agreed with every single one of his political opinions, but it doesn't matter. This man was a man who really served his country, had a great sense of humor, had a nice family, was an independent thinker. I had all the respect in the world for him. And I just want to tell one quick story. My husband and I were in Vietnam about a year and a half ago during Christmas, and we stopped in Hanoi. And of course, we went to the Hanoi Hilton, which is a horrible prison. It was the Hoa Lo prison, which at first was used by the French to hold Vietnamese prisoners when the French occupied Vietnam. And then the Vietnamese later used it to house the U.S. prisoners. John McCain was one of those prisoners. And it was just a horrible place. There was a guillotine there. It was a horrible. The conditions were just astounding. And the idea that he spent time, as much time as he did there, 5.5 years, almost 6 years, and came out, and he would not to say he was unscathed, he was physically hurt, but that he was so mentally strong that he was able to achieve what he did after he left was really an amazing, amazing thing. And interestingly, there's a lake there, and right along the lake, it's called Trukbak Lak Lake, and there's a sign, and I said to my tour guide, oh, Senator McCain was captured here, and I'm thinking, oh, that was a nice little tribute to him. And of course, what I was missing was that they were very happy to have captured him, and they appeared to think that that was a good thing, not a tribute to him. But he was instrumental in getting, you know, the Vietnamese people back with the Americans, and there's very good relations now, due to partly at least his efforts. So rest in peace, and thank you for your service. We have a great show. We're going to be talking about this case of a Wilmette woman who let her daughter walk a dog, and the police were called, and the DCFS was called because she was 8 years old and she was walking the dog alone on a summer day. So we're going to talk to Steve McCollum, who's an expert in the issues of DCFS, and what does it mean? Can you leave your child alone for even a few minutes? And then at 7:30, we're going to talk about gang violence in Chicago. Dr. Lance Williams testified in the Hadiya Pendleton trial that transpired last week, where two young men were convicted of killing the 15-year-old honor student Hadiya Pendleton. He's going to talk about gang affiliation. What is the history of it, and why has it caused Chicago to be so violent? And he may have some ideas about how we're going to cure it that are a little different than what we've been hearing. And then at the top of the hour, 8 o'clock, I'll be taking your legal questions, 981-7200, on any legal topic. But something a little lighter right now, I first want to say, happy National Dog Day. Yes, today's National Dog Day. And the most pressing issue of our time is the trend of pony painting. Okay? This is where children have a party and they bring in a pony and the children use non-toxic paint and they paint the pony and they then wash it off. Okay? And here to join us with the question of the day, which is this something that's animal cruelty? Steve Dale, our Pet World expert, who has a show on 6:30 a.m. on Sunday. Hi, Steve. How are you?
I am great. And by the way, it is a national holiday. So happy National Dog Day to you, too.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. So tell me, let's get right to it. Pony painting. First of all, I never heard of it. But is this something that you would deem personally, being the pet expert and the animal rights person that you are? Is this cruel? And what are the criteria for being cruel?
Well, it's interesting that this should come up now on your show, because I happened yesterday to speak at the All-American Grooming Expo. It's a national show, but happened to be right here in the Chicago area. And I was one of the speakers at that event. And aside from continuing education for groomers, they also had a grooming competition in which the dogs are similarly, they're not painted, but they use dye. And it's a big trend in the Far East, and it's moving to some extent across the world, some small extent, I believe. And it's interesting to see these dogs with pink hearts on them and all these other things.
But we're not talking about dog dignity here. You know, we're not talking about horse dignity. We're talking about, is this cruel to them? I mean, we don't have a lot of time, but what would you say the bullet points are as far as how do you determine if this is something that's acceptable or not acceptable? Do we look at, is this a good thing to teach your children? Or do we look at, does it hurt the horse?
Well, I don't think it is a good thing to teach our children, and it doesn't hurt the horse, but it's silly. Is it cruel? No. You know, I mean, actually, some of the animals love the extra attention that they get, probably.
I would think so.
Yeah, but is it the right thing to do? I don't think so. I think, you know what, these animals are beautiful the way they are. Horses are, I don't even have words in the English language to describe the glamour, the natural beauty which horses have just being horses. And I don't think we need to paint them pretty colors or put stripes on them. In some cases, this is being done by children that are developmentally disabled, and they connect with the horses, so there's some advantage there. The dye that they use doesn't hurt the horses at all. As I said, the horses, in fact, may like the extra attention. So I'm not going to get upset about this one way or the other. I don't know that I'd sign that petition that's out there saying that it's wrong. They ought to be arrested.
There ought to be a law.
I don't think there ought to be a law.
But,
however, I think our horses in general deserve a bit more dignity. But, you know, I'm torn on this, I guess, and that's not, you know, I know you want someone to come on and say, it's right, it's wrong, but, you know, I'm kind of like in between there.
Got it. Steve, thank you so much. And I guess my final say is, if they're going to race horses and put them through that, then I guess painting ponies is not the worst thing, right?
Well put. What a good punctuation mark. Thank you.
Happy Dog Day, and thank you for being such a stable guest. All right.
I make no bones about it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Don't miss Chicago Tribune's first ever night market. Enjoy food, fun, and entertainment August 24th through the 26th. To learn more, visit ctfoodbowl.com/night market.
She broke the needle and she came slow walking the dog. I'm just a walking the dog.
All right. Picture yourself in the Tony suburb of Wilmette, and you see an 8-year-old girl walking with her dog, Marshmallow, the cutest little white dog you've ever seen. So you do what any respectable neighbor does. Of course, you call the police because this child is being neglected, and then you call the DCFS maybe. What? This is what happened to a Wilmette mom, and this mother had to hire a lawyer to clear her name, to represent her, to get the investigation cleared. Can you leave your kids alone? What is this coming to? What is the law in Illinois, and what do we call neglect? With us to discuss this issue is probably the most qualified person in Lake County to talk about it. Steve McCollum was the chief deputy state's attorney for Lake County, and he was in charge of all criminal prosecutions and all prosecutors. He is the former president of the Lake Barty Bar Association, and he has extensive experience in handling these kinds of cases and appeals before the DCFS. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us on short notice. But this story is kind of, I think it's alarming to most of us. You've been on both sides of this issue as a prosecutor and as a defense lawyer. Can you tell maybe the nervous parents out there what the law actually says in Illinois about when you can leave your children alone?
Okay, well, there's actually two different laws, one involving criminal offenses called child abandonment, and that's a felony offense, and that really doesn't apply to this situation at all. It's when you leave a child under 13 without supervision for 24 hours or more, and there's a lot of factors about the child that go into that. There's another law, though, that DCFS deals with, which is for child neglect, and for that statute, it says any minor under the age of 14 years whose parent leaves the minor without supervision for an unreasonable period of time without regard for the mental or physical health, safety, or welfare of the minor, neglects the child. And if DCFS finds that you neglected your child, and they do what is called an indicated finding, and then you have consequences from that indicated finding, you're on the register of DCFS indicating you've neglected a child, which can have some bad effects for people who want to coach basketball teams or soccer teams, teachers, people who do any kind of child care.
Interesting. And I know as a person who practices in the family law area, it does come up when it comes to parenting time and making decisions for the children, because sometimes it's used as a sword by one parent or the other to say that this parent is an unfit parent. So it has a lot of ramifications. But let's go back to the law. And you know, you read words that were in there that talked about what's unreasonable and that what affects the mental and physical health of the child. What is reasonable? I suppose that's the key question here.
Reasonable comes on a case-by-case basis. And the problem with the words in the statute is they really don't have any definition. There's no definition in the statute for what's reasonable for a parent to do, what an unreasonable length of time is. There's a lot of different things on the Internet that will tell you that for this age of a child, you shouldn't leave them for this long and so forth. But that's not in the statute. And it really comes down to what your child is capable of handling and the situation you're putting your child into. So a child who's 8 years old walking her dog in Wilmette, I don't see that's unreasonable at all. But if you sent out your 8-year-old in an area where, you know, there's a lot of gang violence and things like that, it might be different. So every case is different, and every case is determined on its facts. And we hope that the people at DCFS, who have a very hard job to do, will do their job right and consider all the different factors that are out there and the factors of that home. But what we have to remember in this particular case is DCFS had a duty to investigate once they got the report, and we want them to investigate allegations of child neglect or abuse, and they certainly should do that. But I don't think there would have been an indicated finding in this case at all.
And I just go back a little bit. I'm a little bit older, and I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, and my parents were very, very careful with me. In fact, I thought they were very restrictive. And I look around the other children in the neighborhood, but man, we went out when the lights, you know, came on, and we were playing all day in the park. We came home for lunch. We went right back out, and we came back for dinner. And we were young, and we weren't going that far, but we were in the playgrounds. We were playing with our friends. Have things changed? Are the standards much more strict now because our world is less safe?
I think things have changed a lot over the years. Like you, I grew up in a whole different world where when I was in first grade, I rode my bike to school, which was like 4 miles away from where I was.
Uphill in a snowstorm.
And everybody thought that was okay. The people at the school were fine with it. Certainly my parents were fine with it. Nowadays, I don't know if that would be possible for somebody in first grade. In fact, they'd probably have problems with DCFS and the school. So things have changed mainly because we've become more cognizant of all the problems out there, the predators out there, and everybody thinks that any child that's out by themselves might be abused or might have something happen to them. But
and
that's really not the standard either. The standard is whether or not what the parent is doing is reasonable under the circumstances.
Can you give some examples of cases you've either prosecuted or handled? Obviously, you can't go into all the details, but leaving your child in a car, that seems to be a big one, where mom maybe is going into Walmart and she's going to run in to get just a little bit of something, and maybe the child's asleep and she doesn't want to bother the child, you know, and 5 minutes go by and someone calls the police. I'm sure you've handled cases like this. Can you talk a little bit about what sorts of things the DCFS or the police might find to be relevant to find neglect in a particular case?
Well, obviously, if you stop at a supermarket to go in and get something and you leave a very young child in your car, that's a problem, and you're going to end up with several people around your car when you come back outside, and the police will have already been called, and you'll get charged with an offense. I appealed a case where a woman took her young child to the beauty parlor with her, but the child was having its happy meal. When she got to the beauty parlor, she decided to leave the child in the child seat, and while she went inside, and she could see the child the entire time, she parked right next to the shop. But she got called DCFS got called and she was indicated for it, so we had to appeal the decision. And for her, it had real consequences. She worked in child care. But I think under the circumstances where she could see her child the entire time while she was in the beauty parlor, there wasn't really a problem. But DCFS thought different.
Yeah. So. I don't have much time, but I guess I'm just going to say, I always tell parents, you know, if you leave your child home alone for any period of time, have a plan, have a neighbor check on, you know, make sure they have a cell phone, make sure there's a plan for the kids if there's a problem. And those things would go at least toward preventing some sort of DCFS investigation or police action. Steve McCollum, thank you so much for joining us. Can you give your number out for anybody who might need representation in the Lake County area?
Sure, 847-662-2474. The firm is McCollum Hodgkinson, and we do all sorts of DCFS, criminal, and other matters.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. It's the Karen Conti Show. Violence in Chicago has been in the news for years and years, and particularly gang violence. In this past week, we had a trial that the nation was watching and the local news was covering, and that was the murder of Hadiyah Pendleton, a 15-year-old honor student who had just performed at President Obama's inauguration, and she was shot dead in her neighborhood. And two young men were convicted this week of the shooting, Michael Ward and Kenneth Williams. We're going to talk a little bit about gang violence, the history of gang violence, and why this is happening. And we have an expert witness from the trial, Dr. Lance Williams. He is a PhD and associate professor at Northeastern University, and he co-authored the book, The Mighty Black Peacetone Nation, The Rise and Fall and Resurgence of an American Gang. He works with Chicago Public Schools with at-risk elementary and high school students. Welcome so much to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, you testified at the trial, and your client was Kenny Williams, who was the alleged getaway car driver. Is that right?
Correct.
And now, what was the nature of your testimony? I don't think that we could hear that or see that during the week on camera.
Yeah, well, the nature of my testimony was to focus on Kenny's upbringing, his socialization, using just basic research on his life to determine his likelihood of being a gang member.
And why was that important, that he was a gang affiliate? How did the defense use that to, and how did the prosecution use that to convict him?
Well, the state's case revolved around this being a gang-related shooting, a retaliation in which, unfortunately, Hadiyah was accidentally targeted and shot. And so the state's whole case revolved around this being somewhat of an ordered kind of hit. Excuse me. And as an expert witness on gangs, I testified to the changing nature of Chicago, particularly African-American gangs, that they do not exist in that hierarchical kind of structure anymore from a top-down approach. It's more of a what we would call a lateral type of organization and a chaotic infrastructure.
Did you talk to any of the jurors afterwards, or did anyone talk to the jurors to determine whether they believed that he was part of a gang, or that if your testimony was effective?
No.
Yeah.
No.
And it may be that they talk later and they're not going to talk at this point in time. And I'm sure they are a little concerned, too, for their safety, I would think. You know, I think the judge did a pretty good job of making sure that they weren't on camera and the like. But let's talk a little bit about the history of gangs and how you said there used to be a top-down approach. Can you give us a quick gang violence 101 in Chicago about how gangs used to be structured and how and why it changed currently?
Right. So if you trace the most prominent African-American gangs, and I want to distinguish African-American gangs from other gangs, particularly Latino gangs, because Latino gangs have over the years tended to maintain their hierarchy. But African-American gangs have lost it. We can go back 60 years to the origin of some of these gangs and basically see that around the 1970s, we began to see a shift from just regular street gang rivalry type of violence and what we would just call gang banging to changing to a infrastructure of drug selling. And so from the 70s to the 90s, there was a primary focus on selling heroin and selling crack cocaine in the crack cocaine era. That started probably in the late 80s or early 90s. So as you know, a lot of the strongholds for these black street gangs were public housing developments, which we call the projects. When those projects began to be demolished in the late 80s, and also the war on drugs targeted the drug cartels and the leaders of these gangs, all of that went away. The strongholds went away. The leadership went away.
And are you saying this, it created a more chaotic system?
It did. It did.
You know, and it may be even worse.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that you see this type of random violence, and which makes it so difficult to police, because you never know when it's going to pop up. And most of the violence, most people don't acknowledge this, but most of the violence that we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years has not really been gang related, not in the African-American community. It's more interpersonal beef and conflict.
Well, and this is very, very interesting, because one of the things that I learned from you is that essentially we think everything is a gang related hit. And it might be something as simple as you dated my girl and posted it on Facebook, and now I'm going to use my gun and shoot you.
Yeah, it's stuff like that. But primarily, this is really a cultural problem among young African-American males. And it's difficult for mainstream society to really, particularly professionals, law enforcement, elected officials who really know what the problem is. But it would be difficult for a city hall to say, well, look, you know, this black on black male violence really is the issue. So it's easier politically. It's more politically correct to say gang related. People understand that, you know. But the reality is, although these guys may be gang of they may self-identify with a gang, the conflict is not gang related. It's interpersonal. Or, you know, you looked at me improperly, or, you know, because, again, black male identity is centered around a lot of bravado and insecurities as well. And so, you know, the challenge has been to try to help young African-American males feel good about who they are and their, you know, self-identity. The music does a lot to shape, you know, how they behave and act, because it promotes a popular culture that drives gang banging and drug selling.
Does it really? I mean, I know I've heard this a million times, but I just can't imagine what it would have been that formed me in my years by listening to music. But tell us how that works.
It works because there are so many other missing factors. So for us, you know, growing up, maybe we had, you know, strong protective factors. We had strong family, you know, structure. We had, you know, functioning schools. We had, you know, solid communities, right? And so we could, you know, even if we listened to the most ridiculous and were exposed to the most ridiculous media, it wouldn't influence us. But take a kid who has, you know, dysfunctional home, no real school options, community is in chaos. And now what happens is the music begins to shape, you know, your identity and give you hope that if maybe I sell drugs, maybe if I become a gang leader or chief, then that's my way to what? Get out of this situation that I'm in. It makes sense in that particular case. And that's what we have here in our community.
You're listening to Dr. Lance Williams, who is an expert on the history of gangs in Chicago. If you have any questions for him, please give us a call here, 312-981-7200. The Northwestern Wildcat season is upon us, so Coach Fitz will join Steve Cochran's show on Monday at 7:10 a.m.
I came to you that I come to you with the truth. The street took 6 more lives overnight, all the result of gang bang stupidity. By the way, you gangsters should know, one of your victims was a 3-year-old girl. Local gang members, you still don't get it, do you?
It's straight up madness everywhere I look. Used to be a straight A student. Now it's a crook, robbing people just to smoke and shoot up. Used to have a crew cut, now it's a poop butt. Dropped out of school and joins the neighborhood.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking about gang violence with Dr. Lance Williams, who's an expert and the author of The Almighty Black Peace Donation, The Rise and Fall and Resurgence of an American Gang. Professor, I want to talk a little bit about going back to the 1920s and the days of Al Capone and organized crime. Are those types of entities similar in any way to the gangs that we know now?
Well, you mentioned a very key point, and that was organized crime. So the crime was organized because the mafia had relationships with mainstream institutions, political institutions, law enforcement, that they use these relationships to perpetuate their criminal enterprise. The difference is now gangbangers are attempting to further, in many cases, a criminal enterprise without relations with mainstream institutions. So it becomes chaotic, lawless, and completely out of order.
Now, back in the 60s and maybe the 60s, I guess, as I recall it, some of the gangs did some good work, like the Black Panthers. They were interested in civil rights, and they helped some kids and after-school programs and got kids food and that kind of thing. And the gangs are not involved in good things anymore,
right.
At all, are they?
No. Now, the Black Panthers were not a gang. They were a youth political organization.
Okay.
But they were actually a model for traditional gangs like the Blackstone Rangers and the Vice Lords and the Disciples. And so if you recall, during that time was a time of political movement, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movements. These were all at their peak. And so those movements influenced even street gangs. And so street gangs became involved in social movements. They had, you know, free breakfast programs. They had programs where they were about economic development and job training. So, yes, during that era, they were involved in positive things in their communities.
We have a texter from the 414 up in, I guess that's Milwaukee area. He's absolutely right. That's how you feel about yourself is a huge factor in these crimes. If you know that whatever you do reflects not just on you but your family, you're less likely to do something horrible when you have no familial structure. It's a good point. And I know that you also talk about sort of a issue with African American males, where it's kind of there's a depressive societal I don't know what you want to call it going on with them. If you've got, I think you said 47% of all African men are either out of work or out of school. So the idea is they're not happy with themselves, they're not happy with the world, they don't see any hope. And tell us how that catapults into them being in gangs and staying in gangs and emulating that gang culture.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Their life trajectory begins to decline early in life. And so many of these young men, and again, you know, I point to many of the very poor public policies the city of Chicago has implemented over the years. Renaissance 2010, when just public housing was totally demolished without prospects for folks. You know, they were just tossed out and thrown into other under-resourced communities. Renaissance 2010, when schools in the early 2000s were privatized, essentially charter schools, community schools were closed. Kids couldn't go to school outside of their communities because of these boundary issues. The city understood that, but they did it anyway. City comes back later and closes 51 schools. So you have a young African-American male in his community. He can't go to high school, which means he can't find a job, which means he's stuck in his neighborhood, which means then he begins to self-medicate. He's smoking and he's drinking just to cope with his situation. And then he becomes involved with gangs and violence. Many of these young guys, you know, just from my work with them, although I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, they tend to be, in my opinion, depressed. I think they are, you know, just totally depressed about their life situations and circumstances, and anything will set them off. And that's one of the reasons that we have violence. But we can trace that back to the policy, not necessarily blaming the family, but the communities have been decimated by just terrible public policy.
You know, my friend used to be the head of the criminal courts at 26 in California, and I remember sitting in his office, and he looked out, and he held his hand out, and he said, "Witness the largest mental institution in the world," meaning that the vast majority of people who are incarcerated at 26 in California for some of the most horrible crimes you're going to see are almost all literally, you know, depressed or psychotic in some cases, but in need of serious medication. So these are mental health issues, and I think it's really important to understand that a lot of this it has to do with that mental attitude.
Yeah, it's a great deal of stress in these communities. And, you know, this is also a class issue within the African-American community that we haven't addressed. And I think the unfortunate shooting of Hydea and the trial kind of was a reflection of this class issue in the community. You know, you hear the complaints that, well, you know, she is, what makes her special? I mean, she's just one of hundreds of kids who have been killed. Why is all of this attention placed on her?
People are actually saying that?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely.
When in fact, you know, when it's a white kid, you have all the spotlight on that, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, but, you know, but the issue is that because she was connected to the Obamas and Michelle Obama came to her funeral, that it made it such a high-profile case, most people felt in the community that these kids didn't have a chance for a fair trial.
Now, let's talk about policing. And I know that the police are getting blamed for a lot of the gang violence. They're not solving crimes. How do you view the police involvement in solving these kinds of problems?
Well, you know, unfortunately, because this is such a systemic problem that really cannot be policed, it cannot be solved through law enforcement, yet we are thrusting the, you know, police out to kind of solve these issues. They cannot solve it. And so they're frustrated. So it's an issue of a us against them. This is the reason that you see so many police involved shootings. The police are stressed out. The guys in the community are stressed out. And they're all occupying these spaces, these tense, stressed spaces. And it's playing out in violence.
Now, you work with the Chicago Public Schools with people who might be at risk for these issues. Can you kind of describe for us? I mean, we you know, in our communities, we don't know what it's like to be raised. I mean, even if you grew up in a dysfunctional family, which a lot of us have grown up, but at least we had food and we had regularity and we had safety. We walked to school and back and we didn't worry about the stress must be horrible for these people. So can you talk a little bit about what's a typical situation for a young man growing up and the troubles that he gets into and how he gets into them and how you help them?
Right. Well, it starts with school where many of these young men are in spaces where there are no African-American males. Again, you have to understand the African-American male culture in these spaces that is very what I would call very socially non-responsive. So that's an academic term, but basically that as a young man, it's difficult for you to show empathy, to show fear, to show emotions, because then you're perceived as being weak. So you always have to be on your, you know, your A game, on top of everything, and always constantly not putting yourself in a position to be bullied and so that creates this kind of intense energy, and it requires a special individual, other men who understand this, that can help them in their growth and development, and they don't have that. You know, and so what's happening is they are beginning to learn from the streets. They're graded by the streets, and the street says, look, you know, retaliation has to be immediate. You can't be a punk. You have to, you know, oppress other males. In order for you just to be a normal human being, you have to oppress other men. And so you have this, or young men. And so you have to constantly, you know, confront this on a day-to-day basis. Now, if you don't have school options, you don't have a job option, then you're left to this madness 24/7. And it's just overwhelming. And most of these young men, again, I think they're depressed. They smoke. They drink constantly. And when I say smoke, I'm talking about, you know, a lot of this synthetic weed that is really doing, I think, a lot of psychological damage to them. And they just occupy these very small spaces, and it plays out in violence.
We're talking to Dr. Lance Williams. I think we're going to keep you on another segment. Is that okay? On the other side of the hour? Okay.
I would love it.
And if anyone has any questions, I see that some people have some interesting comments. Please give us a call here at 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Lance Williams, who's an expert on the issue of gang violence in Chicago. He was an expert witness in the trial for the murder of Hadiyah Pendleton this last week. Thank you for staying on with us. And listen, I'm going to take your legal calls, but I'm going to do that at about 815-981-7200, 312-981-7200. My producer, Ben, will be taking those calls and logging you in. Dr. Williams, we talked a little bit about schools and about how what happened with Chicago Public Schools has adversely affected the African-American community. Can you explain this to us?
Yes. Yeah, so we essentially have an apartheid school system in Chicago where the vast majority of young African-American students do not have access to quality schools. So that was exacerbated with the school policy of Renaissance 2010, when public schools were essentially many of them turned into charter schools, replacing community schools. So what that meant is a kid who was an eighth grader who lived in Auburn Gresham, young African-American male, who used to go to Calumet High School. I mean, the tradition, the neighborhood high school was Calumet. It was turned into Calumet Perspectives, which meant that it had a admissions standard that the average young male in the community couldn't meet. So that meant he had to go to an open enrollment school like Hirsch High School, on the east side of Chicago, meaning that he had to travel out of his neighborhood and cross maybe five or six gang boundaries to get to school. This kid says, no way, this is a death sentence, and he's right, so he doesn't go to school. And we've got thousands and thousands of young African-American males who have not gone to school since eighth grade over the last 10 or 15 years.
Now, that makes sense to me, because I did know that people were protesting, but I didn't understand the logistics of yes. what that was causing. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Anthony. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a question for Dr. Williams.
Well, yes, I've been hearing this narrative, not just from the doctor, but from many other sources where, you know, if only we had more jobs in these neighborhoods, you know, things would improve. But you can't expect a business owner to want to go into this neighborhood and open a business. It's kind of like what came first, the chicken or the egg. I mean, if I were a business owner, I would not want to take the risk associated with a business in those communities when I can do much better somewhere safer.
Okay. Thanks, Anthony. I'm going to have Dr. Williams address that.
Yes, no, I agree with you. And I'm not saying only if you had more jobs. Jobs will not solve this problem at this point. It's too far out of control. So what we need are functioning institutions like functioning schools. We need functioning faith. Businesses, functioning businesses are part of it. But we need opportunities for education so that kids are prepared for those jobs. And also, again, there's a cultural issue that we need to confront that no one has dealt with at this point.
So if let's go back to some of the solutions to the problem. I know that you spoke spoke with a gentleman who has ties with organizations like Cure Violence and Ceasefire. And those organizations have been fairly successful. The stats indicate that they are fairly successful in helping some of these problems. Can you explain what organizations like those do for the community?
Well, I think what they do is they bring a temporary stabilization of conflict mediation. So if there is a conflict brewing, because they hire individuals who have street credibility, in many cases, those guys can go out and mediate these problems. But essentially what's happening is they're running around neighborhoods putting out fires. And if they run to this side and put out a fire, then another one pops up on the other side because we have not addressed this from a systemic issue.
Right. Yeah. So what you're saying, these organizations are like they run interference and try to prevent people from getting violent with their personal disputes.
Yes, and retaliations. They do a good job with after a shooting has occurred to then go to the neighborhood and the community because they have street credibility. They can talk to both sides and maybe prevent a retaliation. But statistically, that cannot be proven. So the whole idea of these programs being effective in reducing violence is you cannot prove that statistically. I know a lot of people say they come there university-based institutions, but the reality is that they cannot be statistically proved. There are a lot of people in the community that are attempting to resolve these conflicts. So one group cannot take credit for resolving or bringing violence down in a neighborhood.
Understood. Yeah. And one of the things I'm going back a little bit here to something we discussed, which is sort of the feelings of a young African-American man growing up and some of the feelings that he has. And we talked during the break off mic about kind of the projection of self-hatred. Can you put those into words, as you were very articulate about that, and I think it explains a lot.
Yeah, I think this is the gorilla or the elephant in the room that folks are afraid to deal with because it's not politically nice and neat. But the issue is a cultural one of black male identity that is, I would say, highly dysfunctional in many cases, where there is a sense of, because of low status in mainstream society, too many young African-American males have a sense of self-hatred, which then they project onto other young African-American males like themselves. And when you have a culture that is rooted in this identity of the alpha dog being, you know, the top dog on the block. Everyone feels like this. You cannot have a lower status. Then you have this fight back and forth of not being intimidated, not being punked, not the effeminization of black males is huge, not to be treated like, you know, we say the B word, and that your whole life is around not being treated like that. So when you walk out of the house, your main focus is that I have to maintain my status. And so this self-hatred, this frustration then becomes projected onto other guys like you because you see yourself in them and you get this hyperviolence. And until we can get in the middle and break that cycle of self-hatred, this thing is going to continue to spiral out of control.
And for girls, is there a special problem for girls? We talk a lot about the boys in the neighborhood and the men. Do the girls have similar problems or different problems?
Yeah, the girls have similar problems because, again, this culture, this new emerging, when I say new emerging culture, this is something that has really been going on for the last 30 years and has been perpetuated through the gangster rap music, right, that exacerbates this problem, right? It's creating this emotionally non-responsive male, and because girls occupy this space, they also have to act in this way. And so now what we're seeing is young African-American women are going to jail at a faster rate than black males.
Wow. Wow, that's just terrifying. We're going to have to end it here, but thank you for joining us. And will you come back and talk some more?
Absolutely. Anytime.
This is a great topic. Dr. Lance Williams, thank you so much for coming on. Dr. Williams, associate professor at Northeastern University and co-author of the book, The Almighty Black Peacestone Nation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Watch Micah and Joe, Mike Mottier and Joe Donlin weeknights on WGN News at 9. You're listening to WGN. Thanks to Dr. Lance Williams. That was a very, very interesting conversation, and I hope we can keep in contact with him and get some more of that, because it really does give us some insight into sometimes we live in different neighborhoods. Chicago is a very segregated area, and I know I live in a neighborhood where you know you don't always know these things, and you don't always understand how the different legislation, how different things affect people in other neighborhoods. But thank you so much. This is the time I'm going to take your legal calls. We're getting started a little late, but we can get in all of your calls, 981-7200-312-981-7200. I'll try to answer the question as best I can, or steer you in the right direction on any legal topic. If you have questions about contracts, estate planning, criminal law, family law, I'll try to help you along. 312-981-7200, or text to that number. And if for some reason you don't get through, or you would like to talk to me privately, the best way to do it is to call me, 312-332-7800, or you can email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. That's KarenConti. And you can give me some facts and where you live and what your expectations are, and maybe I can help you and steer you in the right direction, whether that's to tell you you have a lawsuit or you maybe don't have a lawsuit, or to find you a lawyer in your area who can help you along. I do want to talk, while the calls are coming in, 981-7200. I want to talk about this. All right. I'm going to give you some names, and I'm going to ask the question, what do these people have in common? Prince, Amy Winehouse, Pablo Picasso, Howard Hughes, Sonny Bono, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, and Aretha Franklin. Ben, any ideas? Ben, my producer, any ideas what they have in common? Nope.
Well, I don't know. That's a tough one.
All of those people have in common, they did not have a will.
Really?
They did not have an estate plan. Huh. Aretha Franklin died with $80 million, they say, and she did not have an estate plan. So I guess what I'd like to do is to use our Queen of Soul to teach a lesson to everybody. Listen, you got to have an estate plan. You don't have to have $80 million to have one, but you really should have one. All kinds of things can happen when you don't have it. You think it's going to be easy. You think everything's going to your kids or going to your husband. Maybe it's not the way you think it's going to be. For instance, if you have a spouse and children, half of it goes to your spouse and half of it goes to your children, unless you have a will. If you want to leave it all to your spouse, you better get an estate plan or a trust in place, and you better make sure it's correct and make sure it's done correctly. And I know they have online wills and trusts, and, you know, I'm not a big fan of those because you're not sure whether or not you're doing it correctly. You're not sure whether or not it's the proper form. And you might also have tax ramifications that the forms don't really take into account. So if you need an estate lawyer, someone who can plan your estate for you, give me a call at the office or give me a call here and I can refer you to somebody, 312-332-7800. And I'll find you someone in your neighborhood. I know a lot of people don't like to come downtown because it's hard to park and all that. So I do have people in the northwest suburbs and the western suburbs and Will County. I've got good people who do estate planning there. So it's good to get a lawyer to refer you to somebody who knows what they're doing. I don't do this kind of work. So it's not that I'm looking for the business, but I would like to refer you to, you know, to somebody who you can trust and somebody who will do a good job at a reasonable price. So let's go to, looks like Ed from the 815. Hi, Ed. Welcome to WGN.
Hi there. Had a very close relative just recently attacked inside a motel in Naperville. Needed an ambulance, you know, CT scan, kept overnight. I've made a phone call to one of these attorneys that you see advertising on TV. They said there is, you know, that, you know, the hotel isn't responsible. It just sounds like they should be. I remember that case of the Sports Illustrated lady, Erin Anderson.
Yeah,
and she was just
right.
Spied upon, and she got millions. So what happens when you're beaten?
Okay, I'm just curious. Who was it that beat this relative of yours? Was it someone who worked there? So someone who got in the room?
Not an employee. Just someone else who was, I don't even know if they were a guest, but they were within the motel.
Okay, and I guess I'm just prying a little bit here, but is it someone
yeah.
that your friend knew, or is it someone who just randomly became violent with him?
They were engaged in conversation, and then he was attacked, beaten, you know, robbed of his wallet, robbed of some computer equipment, knocked unconscious.
Okay. All right. Well, here's my assessment of this. A hotel or motel has a duty to keep its guests safe. And because people are coming there, you know, they have a duty to make sure that the people that come in are not there to do harm to their guests. They need to make sure there's proper security. They need to make sure that rooms are locked safely. And as in the Aaron case, you know, they basically let people up and they knew who knew that she was a celebrity and allowed them to look into the room. So, in this case, you would have to probably prove that this person was not supposed to be on the premises. If he was another patron and he just became violent, that's a harder case. But there would have to be some facts to show that the hotel had a duty to your friend and they breached the duty. That's kind of how you put the parameters. I know I'm sounding like a lawyer, but...
The friend is actually my son, so...
Okay, your son. Okay. I'm sorry to hear that. Very sorry to hear that. So these kinds of... I had a case, just for example, of a guy who was staying in a hotel motel. It was really a motel in a very kind of iffy neighborhood, and... Turns out someone broke into his room and hurt him and robbed him. Same type of thing. And what happened was we found out that the security lights had been knocked out, and they had been knocked out for months, and no one put them back together so that it was dark and it allowed people to come in there. There had been like 3 or 4 robberies in the last month. So the motel was charged with the duty to do something about the violence there. So I think what you want to do is you can give me a call. I can give you a referral to somebody in the county where it happened so they can investigate it. Maybe they're going to spend a little time looking into whether or not this motel maybe had some other issues to ask the right questions to determine whether there might be a case here. And again, it may be that there's not, but there's certainly some duty that the motel has to your son or had to your son. And if it's breached, you have a lawsuit. So give me a call at the office, okay?
Okay. One other thing. I just returned from 4 days in Colorado, training. You know, every night, different hotel, motel, and I always thought that they were, you know, responsible. You know, if something happens on their grounds, that it's, you know, if I slip and fall, you know, they're responsible. If I'm attacked, like, I might not be.
It's really not like that. People have that idea, but, you know, I'm going to put you on hold for a minute. So, no, it's not just automatic liability. It's not like you walk in and you trip and fall and you can sue the motel. There has to be a breach of duty. And basically, the law says that if you're creating a safe environment and some criminal comes and that's the main cause of the injury. So let's just say that someone breaks in and you have no idea that this was going to happen, that the security was all in place, but this guy barged in and he had a gun and he shot somebody. Well, the hotel would argue, listen, that's terrible what happened, but we don't have the obligation to have fail-safe security. We had all our security people in place. We had everything that the best we could. We met all the standards of care for motels and hotels. We had all the security cards and everything in place, but this guy was the cause of the problem. It's not us. So no, that the answer to that is no. And I know that people think that, you know, when you're in a place that it must, they must guarantee your safety. And that's just not true. Same with the slip and fall. There has to be a known problem. You know, there has to be a hole in the ground and they knew about the problem and other people have gotten hurt there before. You have to show that this was something that they could have remedied had they been exercising due care. I'm using the lawyer words. Let's go to a break, but I'm going to continue to take your legal questions. 981-7200-321-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. I'm taking your legal calls right now. The phone lines actually are wide open, and Ben's sitting there with nothing to do. He looks like he's kind of forlorn because he doesn't have anything to do. So please give him a call and then keep him company, and then keep me company and keep us all company. 312-981-7200. Any questions you might have? Family law. I bet you have some family law questions. Everyone is getting divorced. Everyone has been divorced. But going back to school, college, that's a real interesting issue when your child is going away to college. How do parents pay for it? If you have any of those questions, give me a call, 981-7200. I'll give out my information off the air. Number there at the office anytime is 312-332-7800. And when you do leave a message, give me some facts. Don't just call, because then I'll call back, then you'll call back, and it gets lost in the shuffle. So just give me, it's a confidential line, and you're going to give me whatever facts you think are necessary, where you are, when it happened, and what your expectations are. And then my email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com. That's KarenConti. I'm going to get to your phone lines. I'm seeing that they're heating up. But I got a texter just today, actually, who made a comment and said, can you explain why people are referring to Rudy Giuliani as Mayor Giuliani and why certain other dignitaries are not being referred to by their former title? And it's interesting. I know a little bit about this, and I actually looked it up on several websites. And interestingly, if you have held a job in the past that now has a different person in that position, it is incorrect technically to continue to call you mayor, or mayor or senator. So that, you know, because you don't want to be confused with the person who's actually mayor at the time. So if I saw Richard Daley on the street, I technically shouldn't call him Mayor Daley, although I might just call him mayor because I'm sure that's what everyone calls him. But technically, you're not supposed to, that you would call him the Honorable, you could call him Mr. Interestingly, presidents are the same, go by the same rule. So that even though Barack Obama, everyone calls him president, everyone calls George Bush President Bush, the technical way to refer to him would be either the Honorable or Mr. President or Mr. Obama. A lot of people will always call a president president. But interestingly, for instance, judges, and I know this very well, because judges, there's a number of them, or if you're a professor, or if you are in the military, and there's lots of generals, and there's lots of corporals, it's okay if you're a former judge or corporal or professor to still call you by that name. So in my world, when a judge is off the bench and he's retired, or she came off the bench because she went back into private practice, I will always refer to that person as Judge Miller, Judge Jones. because there are numerous judges. So again, that's technicality, and I think that a lot of people make those mistakes, but they do it out of respect, not out of some ill will. All right, let's go to the lines. We're getting some calls in, 981-7200. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a family law question.
Yes, I do. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
I just got my children back after about 6 months of them being with their mother, and our divorce decree stated that daycare should be paid equally. Whenever she submitted a daycare receipt to me, I made sure that it was paid in full. Since the kids have been back with me, I have submitted $810 daycare bills within the last month, which she's responsible for equally, and she made a $40 payment. Now, that's harming me financially because I can't pay my bills or buy food for the kids. It's very difficult for that. I don't make much money. My mortgage is going to be due, and she says that she feels that she's legal as long as she's making a payment. I'm like, well, the kids need to eat. The kids need clothes. They need, you know, their utilities. So I don't know where I stand on this.
Okay, Scott, can I just ask you a question that may not be on the same topic? But you said that you got the children back after 6 months of them being with your ex-wife or the mother of their children. What caused that to happen, that they were with her for six months?
I was the sole custodial parent from 2016 until February 28th of this year. When the children were with their mother one weekend, I had some drinks, and she found out about it, and she knew her kids were coming back, and she called police. Police took them away. She filed a emergency order. They put a guard that light them in, blah, 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 and I've been sober since, and so the GAL recommended the children come back to me.
Got it. Okay.
Because I'm a more stable home.
Okay, got it.
But during that time, I was making, when she said she submitted a receipt for daycare, I paid it every time.
Okay.
Kids needed something, you know, and I'm like, well, why can't you do that for me?
Okay, let me explain just a little bit about daycare. Daycare is one of those things that you pay it over and above child support. So you have the children primarily, so she should be paying child support. I don't know if she is, but even if
she's not doing that either.
She should be paying child support. And in addition to that, she should be paying half of the daycare while they're with you. And the purpose of this, according to the judges, is that the only reason you're able to go to work to make money to support your children is because you have this daycare or a babysitter or after school care or whatever it is. You can call it whatever you want. And that both parents should share in that while they're with you. Okay. Now, your question is $800. Is that enough to go hire a lawyer about? No, it isn't. And you need the money now. So this is not something that can be solved very easily. But what you can do is you can call the state's attorney. Are you in Cook County?
I'm in Lake County, but I do have an attorney already involved in this. I've had one since 2017.
Okay.
So I wanted to send, because we're on the Family Wizard, and I wanted to send all this information and text messages back and forth to her, because
Hold on. Let me just go one by one here, because I want to make sure everyone understands what we're talking about, and I'm trying to give some advice to other people besides you. So basically, $800, you know, I know you have a lawyer, but you're not going to hire a lawyer for $800, because by the time you're done with bringing this to court, going to court three times, and having the order entered, you're going to spend $2,000 to get $800. So I recommend that if anything, your lawyer can write a letter to her saying, I demand that you pay this immediately. But going to court on it, unless you use the state's attorney in your area, sometimes the state's attorney, like in Cook County, you can go to the state's attorney and have them enforce child support and some of these other orders, and they do it for free. They take a little bit longer than a private lawyer, but they can do a good job, and they can get you what you need. But hiring a lawyer right now is probably not a good idea, even though you're telling me, I understand, you're living paycheck to paycheck, and you need to have this reimbursement, otherwise you're not going to be able to afford to live. I just think that it's one of those things you might have to just put it on the back burner until there's enough money accumulated to justify going back to court, unless you want to do it yourself. And that's always a hard thing, because it sounds like you've got your hands full with children and working, and then you're going to file a motion and have to show up in court and wait 2 hours in front of a judge. So this is one of those things that I feel terrible for you, but there's no good legal answer on how to do this inexpensively. Okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks, and good luck to you. Take care. And I hope if your mother of your children is out there listening, really, you've got to pay these guys and gals who don't pay support. You put people in such bad situations, and I just wish that wasn't part of my job, that I had to constantly hear that people aren't meeting their obligations to feed their children. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Will Dave and Steve Ennett conquer the Tough Mudder Run? I think they did, because I saw it on Facebook. Spoiler alert, tune in Monday to the Steve Cochran Show at 8:40 a.m. to find out. We're taking your legal calls. This is the last opportunity. I think the phones, we're having some problems with our phones here, but I think we're working it out. But certainly you can text me, 981-7200. Just an anecdote about printing legal forms from the internet. A listener says, I downloaded a power of attorney form and had it signed and notarized. Later, after the property owner became senile, I discovered the POA did not cover his estate, and most of his assets were in the estate. It's been awful getting access to those funds. And I'm not sure exactly what the texter means, but I know those forms are very popular, and when you die, you won't know how they work out. So it's kind of like one of those things where you kind of do it on a prayer, and it really makes sense to hire a lawyer and get it done the right way to make sure that your family's not fighting. I had a case that is just resolving itself now, and a woman died 7 years ago, and she left a trust, and the trust had two trustees, which probably wasn't good estate planning, because the two trustees, the brother and the sister, were fighting about what happened and what should be done with the home and what should be done with the assets of the estate. So 7 years later, we're just resolving the case now. So there was an estate plan, but the lawyer who did it probably didn't do a very good job, was a very inexpensive gentleman who was up in years himself and probably wasn't equipped to do a good job. And as a result, there was 7 years of litigation over assets that really probably, frankly, weren't worth fighting about. Anyway, so these horror stories, you can there's a million of them. 981-7200, get your calls in. I'm going to talk about an email who emailed me a couple weeks ago, Ken, and he said that he was served with a notice to come to court as a witness in a criminal case. And it was an incident that happened a year ago, and he was in a store parking lot during an armed robbery in broad daylight. It happened close to home. There were cameras that covered everything. He does not know why he was being subpoenaed to come to court, but he didn't want to come because he's very concerned about people in the neighborhood and the perpetrators retaliating against him, and he feels that he's not safe, and he asked me if he can avoid and just not show up for the subpoena. And as I told Ken, who's a nice listener, I said, listen, this is putting you in a really bad spot. I get it, but you cannot ignore a subpoena. Whenever you get a subpoena that says come to court, you have to come to court. And if you don't, the judge can issue what we call a bench warrant, which means that they're going to come out and they're going to get you and arrest you and bring you to court. And you might actually be locked up or handcuffed for not coming to court. So that's never, never a good idea when you get a subpoena to avoid it. Now, that said, it's really dangerous out there. And I understand that you have serious problems. And this is why crimes don't get solved in Chicago. A lot of the police officers who you will talk to will say that basically, a lot of people don't want to testify against people. They don't even want to report crimes because they're afraid of the retribution from gang members or the people in the community. So it's something that I would say, Ken, you should call up the prosecutor. And you should say, listen, I'm very concerned for my safety. Do you absolutely need me? Is there a way you can guarantee my safety or my anonymity until I'm absolutely needed? And hopefully I'm not. And see if the prosecutor can probably, can do something to maybe guarantee or at least not really guarantee, but help make you safer. It's a bad situation to be in. Margaret from the 312 area code says, what is the average cost for a simple estate plan document? And thank you for that. I get that question a lot, and really it depends. I mean, I know that's not a very good answer, but I've seen estate plans for $2,000. I've seen estate plans that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Obviously, if you have the fewer assets you have and the fewer piece, if you don't have a real estate or you don't have a lot of heirs, things can be done very simply and very quickly. But you're going to need power of attorney for health care, power of attorney for your business decisions, and you're going to need a trust probably, or a will, or a simple will to get your property distributed without going through probate. And again, probate is the process of having the courts decide how the money gets distributed via will, or if you don't have a will, intestate is what they call it. So you want to avoid that because probate is extremely expensive. It happens for a long period of time, and you want to avoid that at all costs because it could eat up all of the assets that you've worked hard and saved for and that you want to give to your family members. 312-981-7200. Should I take Kathy, Ben, or are we? Can I take Kathy? Okay, in a minute. I wanted to talk briefly about a story that I saw. A pregnant woman in Washington State said she was fired via a text message from a sub shop. I'm not going to name the sub shop, but she basically said, "I'm not getting any shifts. Why aren't you calling me back?" And someone from the company said, "I'm sorry to inform you, but it's not going to work out with company. It's not a good time to have somebody who is leaving for maternity leave in several months anyway. You failed to tell me this during your interview." Well, unbeknownst probably to the employee, that's illegal. That's Exhibit A for discrimination against a pregnant woman. And just so you know, you cannot discriminate against women. You cannot discriminate against men. You cannot discriminate against somebody because they're a certain race, a certain religion, national origin, military status, in most places, sexual orientation, and those types of things. And of course, discrimination based upon age and handicap. But in this case, a lot of people don't know that you can't discriminate against a pregnant woman. And certainly you shouldn't be saying it in an email. But anyway, it's something that I've seen my entire life. I've handled numerous cases with women who are pregnant. In fact, I had a case of a woman who went in and they told her, "We can't hire you because you're pregnant," and it turns out she wasn't pregnant. So even that is illegal, because if you're not being hired because someone thinks you're pregnant, that's just as bad as not hiring somebody or firing them because they are. So make sure you know that out there. All you bosses, even small business owners, should know that. Let's go to Kathy on first line here. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just had a question about where I'm at work. It can be, the culture can be a little abusive. I've had a person of authority, male, back me up against a wall, yell, scream at me, unable to stop when I've asked him to stop. And then I've had another person of authority humiliate me and actually throw things at me. Oh. I did put in an incident report, but I know I'm at an at-will state. I work in Illinois. With it being easier to get rid of me than changing the culture, do I have any recourse, or is it just time to find another job?
That's a really good question. Okay, first of all, it's just beyond me why employers feel the need to do these kinds of things. You shouldn't be in the business of managing people if you can't control your temper. And I'm sorry that's happening to you. Really sorry, but this is the straight legal answer. Unless they're doing it because you're a woman, because you're pregnant, because you're a certain age, that is not illegal conduct, except for the fact that it's assault and battery. If someone is pushing you up against a wall, if someone is yelling at you to the point where you think they're going to hit you, if someone throws things at you, that's not just employment problem, that's a crime. And there needs to be something done there. The problem is, and I think I can hear this fear in your voice, if I confront and if I make a report and if I do all these things, then I'm going to be fired. And even if it's illegal to do that to you, because it's retaliatory in nature, you're still going to be out of a job and you're going to be on the street. So that's a hard place to be, because certainly you have the right to file a police report. But then what's going to happen? Kathy, if you filed a police report, what would happen?
I have not filed a filed a police report. I just made an incident report to my higher-ups, higher than these folks that have done this. And I have found that they tend to side with, they're all physicians, they tend to side with the physicians and not so much with the nurses.
Are physicians that are trying to harm you. Whoa, that seems really ironic, doesn't it? It's just, you know. What I'm saying is, let's just say that you filed a police report. Would they fire you? I take it they would just fire you.
Yeah, they would. It's easier to get rid of me than change the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it's one of those things that you're going to have to call it. I think you did the right thing by filing the incident report. I think you should document, you should follow up. Everything should be in writing. I'm sending this to you again. It's an unsafe work environment. People are going to get hurt. And meantime, you got to get another job because you're not going to change this culture. It seems like these people are arrogant and think that this is their own personal playground and they can treat people this way. And it's really awful. And I'm sorry that you have to experience it. But
okay.
All right. Take care, Kathy. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening, everyone. And I'm going to give my numbers out again in case you have a legal question that you want to talk to me about the week. Or if you have a topic. If you have a topic that is of interest to you, a news topic or something that I haven't covered, please let me know. I'm always interested in that. 312-332-7800 or, better yet, WGN @AskKarenConti.com.